Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's March 26, 2021 program. How can we achieve universal access to healthcare? This is the 26th program of our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, University of Oregon, Peace Health, and Lane Community College, as well as generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. Today's program is sponsored by Oregon Physicians for a National Health Program, advocating better care to more people for less money in Oregon and nationally. In today's program, we welcome presenters John Kitzhaber, Susan Bailey, and Tom Cooney. In addition to earning an MD and practicing medicine for many years, John Kitzhaber is Oregon's longest-serving governor. Susan Bailey, MD, is a practicing allergist, immunologist, and was elected as president of the American Medical Association in 2020. Thomas Cooney, MD, is a professor of medicine at Oregon Health Science University and chair-elect of the Board of Regents of the American College of Physicians. More complete biographical information on our speakers is available on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank Andrew Kolich for coordinating today's program. In January 2020, the American College of Physicians released a new plan for the American healthcare system in a series of policy papers titled Better is Possible, the American College of Physicians' Vision for the U.S. Healthcare System. A central component of this plan was the call for universal access to care, in other words, a system that provides medical care regardless of a person's place of residence, employment, health status, or income. This call placed the American College of Physicians in conflict with many other medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, which in 2019 narrowly rejected a call to endorse single payer and has instead focused on other solutions to improve access to care. We are proud to welcome two amazing leaders from these organizations to share their perspectives. We are also lucky to have former Governor John Kitzhaber as our moderator. Governor Kitzhaber will share insights about the challenges and opportunities he confronted in seeking to modernize Oregon's healthcare system, and he will lead the question and answer portion with the panelists and a few City Club members and guests.
Hi, my name is Andrew Kalick, and I'm a member of the Program Committee of the City Club of Eugene and the coordinator of today's program. Thank you so much for tuning in to this important conversation about how to achieve universal access to healthcare in Oregon and throughout the country. We've got a tremendous group of experts waiting for you today. We're going to have their opening statements now, followed by Q&A and some questions from our live virtual studio audience. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to former Governor John Kitzhaber of the state of Oregon. Governor Kitzhaber.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Andrew. And I want to thank the Eugene City Club for sponsoring this forum and also for inviting me to moderate what I think will be a very interesting and timely conversation with two great leaders of American medicine, Dr. Susan Bailey and Dr. Tom Cooney, at a time when I think leadership is certainly at a premium in our country. Dr. Bailey, it's an honor to meet you and to give you a warm virtual welcome to the great state of Oregon here. And Tom, it's always good to see you, and it's great to be on a panel with you. The topic today, as Andrew said, is how do we achieve universal access to healthcare, which is something that both the American Medical Association and the American College of Physicians are keenly interested in. And in the next 20 minutes or so, our two guests are going to describe how their respective organizations are trying to meet this challenge of universal coverage. I've been asked to take a few minutes at the beginning here and sort of set up the conversation, maybe provide a bit of a larger context. So to do that, I want to add a second question to the title of our conversation today. how to achieve universal access to healthcare, and how to keep Americans healthy, which aren't necessarily the same thing. And I think most of us at the end of the day are interested in health. So in other words, I don't think most of us actually want to need medical care or want to be patients in the US healthcare system. We'd much rather be healthy, right? Obviously, when we're sick or injured, we need access to affordable quality medical care, which is why universal coverage is so very important. But in a sense, healthcare is a means to an end rather than an end in itself. It doesn't have any intrinsic value outside its relationship to a positive health outcome or the alleviation of suffering, except as an economic commodity, which unfortunately is being viewed as in some quarters today, certainly some large private investment funds. It's also important to point out, if in fact our larger goal, our larger context is health, is that among those things that have the biggest impact on our lifetime health status, medical care is not a major contributor. It's important, but the really important things are things like healthy pregnancies, nutrition, housing, safe communities, stable families, education, good jobs. In other words, the social determinants of health, which I'll come back to in just a moment. When we talk about access to healthcare, we're almost always talking about financial access, that is having health insurance coverage, the ability to pay for the care that we need without suffering economic hardship, without struggling with huge co-pays and deductibles, or having to choose between rent or the medical bill, or worrying about surprise billings. So why is coverage so important? It's important for a very simple reason, because today the cost of healthcare exceeds the ability of most of us, most individuals, to pay for it. In fact, if you think about it, healthcare is the only economic sector that produces goods and services that most of its customers can't afford. And the only way this works economically is because the cost of healthcare is heavily subsidized for individuals with public, increasingly with public resources. So let me give you an example. Let's say that the unit cost of healthcare is $100 a month, but your household budget only lets you pay $75 a month until you have to start cutting back somewhere else. So there's two ways that we can make that healthcare for you and your family more affordable. One way is to reduce the unit cost of healthcare from that $100 a unit cost down to $75. The other way to do it is to have somebody else, some third party, subsidize your healthcare by paying 25% of the bill. So the unit cost is still $100, but you're only paying $75 because of that subsidy. Well, the US healthcare financing system is based almost entirely on that second strategy, that is using public subsidies to make healthcare more affordable to individuals. And those public subsidies are given either directly through programs like Medicare and Medicaid, or indirectly through the tax premium subsidies that you get in the Affordable Care Act, the ACA marketplace, healthcare.gov, if that's where you get your insurance, or through what's called the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored coverage. And that simply means that the health insurance premiums paid by employers are exempt from federal income and payroll tax. And that amounts to about a $270 billion public subsidy each year of employer-sponsored coverage. The point I'm trying to make is over 92% of Americans rely on some kind of public subsidy to help them pay for the cost of their health care. Now, we still have almost 30 million people with no health insurance coverage. And they're joined by tens of millions of people who might have workplace-based coverage, but they're facing co-payments and deductibles so high that for all practical purposes, they're uninsured. The American Rescue Plan, the big new COVID relief package that President Biden signed on March 11th, adds about $24 billion to expand access to healthcare for people, mostly through increasing the subsidies in the ACA individual market that we just discussed. And those subsidies are incredibly important to help people afford healthcare, particularly at this very, very difficult time. And I'm very glad that they were included in the package. But here's the problem, one I hope that we can discuss a little bit today. The national health policy debate continues to be focused almost entirely on making healthcare more affordable for individuals by increasing public subsidies, which is not the same as reducing the total cost of care itself. It simply puts more money, more public money, into a system that's fairly inefficient, certainly hyperinflationary, the cost of which has grown from about $8,400 a person in 2010 to over $12,000 a person today. And the size of the healthcare economy is expected to grow by 60% between now and 2028, with price increases accounting for about 40% of that. So it's this growing drain on public subsidies that's undermining our ability to invest in the social determinants of health that I mentioned earlier, and to make the social investments that are necessary to actually improve the health of the population and to address longstanding racial and ethnic inequities that are reflected in growing health disparities and diminishing educational and economic opportunities afflicting primarily low-income Americans, and particularly indigenous people and Black people and other people of color. So the point is, I think any discussion involving a conversation about how we can expand coverage with public subsidies needs to also include, I think, a conversation of how we reduce the total cost of care itself. Certainly, the Medicare for All approach and most public options seek to reduce administrative costs by eliminating or narrowing the role that private commercial insurance plays in today's healthcare system. But even if we can overcome the political obstacles and get that done, and those obstacles are not insignificant, there are many studies that identify additional waste that is embedded in the way healthcare is organized and delivered. And that would include things like poor care coordination, failure in care delivery, over-treatment, low-value care, and overpricing. Some of the studies, including the one that the Institute of Medicine did in 2012, pegged the size of that waste at 25% of the total spend. So it's my hope that in addition to having a good conversation comparing and contrasting the approaches taken by the American Medical Association and the American College of Physicians to achieve a universal access, we can also have a conversation about how to reduce the total cost of care itself. Not just by reducing administrative waste, which I think is very, very important, but also trying to reduce the clinical and utilization waste that also contributes to the growing price tag of the U.S. healthcare budget. So let me just close by saying that I really believe that we are in a race with time here. Unless we can figure out how to reduce the cost footprint of the U.S. healthcare system, or at least reduce its growth rate to a sustainable level, and to reinvest some of those resources upstream in our children and our families, in our communities, it's going to be almost impossible to continue to improve the health of the American population and to address these chronic disparities and inequities that continue to tarnish our nation, what Robert Kennedy referred to as the conditions of injustice that underlie disease. So with that, I would like to turn it to Dr. Bailey, and I'm very anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you so much, Governor, and thanks to the City Club of Eugene for having me today. I wish we could all be together in person, but this is the next best thing. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity. As the Governor said, I'm Dr. Susan Bailey. I'm the current president of the American Medical Association. I'm also an allergist, immunologist, and independent practice in Fort Worth, Texas. So my perspective on health reform and universal health coverage comes from my position as head of the AMA and also as a practicing physician in this very challenging time. Of course, we didn't need a pandemic to tell us the importance of people having access to the healthcare and health coverage they need, but the devastating impact of COVID-19 has brought new urgency to this conversation. Resulting from this urgency, critical improvements to the Affordable Care Act were included, as the governor mentioned, in the most recent American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. And under that, effective this year and next year, but not forever, individuals and families eligible for financial assistance to purchase coverage on the ACA marketplaces will get more help so that they're better able to afford the premiums. And what has been referred to as the ACA's so-called subsidy cliff has been eliminated. This means that there's no longer an income ceiling restricting eligibility to receive financial help with premiums under the ACA. Now, the AMA has long been in support of these improvements to the ACA, and we believe they should be made permanent to ensure our patients have access to affordable health insurance coverage. Beyond these changes, we also now have to take advantage of this unique opportunity to fulfill the promise of the ACA to cover the uninsured. With these and other improvements contained in the COVID-19 relief bill, we can truly build upon the ACA and not start over from scratch. Now, nearly 15 million of the non-elderly uninsured in this country are eligible for premium tax credits to purchase marketplace coverage. Millions more are eligible for Medicaid and CHIP, but remain uninsured. So where do we go from here? Well, first, I think it makes sense to start with the low-hanging fruit. many of the uninsured are simply not aware that they're eligible for Medicaid or CHIP, or that they can receive financial assistance for coverage on ACA marketplaces. Outreach and education is critical, and we are very glad that the Biden administration is taking steps to improve ACA outreach and enrollment, including launching a special enrollment period for marketplace coverage. Next, millions of the uninsured are either eligible for zero premium plans on the ACA marketplaces or in Medicaid and CHIP. Auto-enrolling these individuals in health insurance coverage at no cost to them seems to be a good place to start. Individuals also need more help in affording their cost-sharing responsibilities, deductibles, co-payments, and the like. We need to make the current help under the ACA more generous and available to more people. And we also need to provide assistance with premiums to those who still can't receive the help they need, including those who only have the option of unaffordable employer coverage. Also, uninsured young adults may need more financial incentive to get covered, to combat the notion of the young invincibles that we often hear about. Importantly, we need to focus on the poorest in our society. More than 2 million people with incomes below the federal poverty level can't access Medicaid coverage or premium help to purchase ACA marketplace coverage because they reside in states like mine that have not expanded Medicaid. Now, the American Rescue Plan did contain significant financial incentives to encourage more states to expand their Medicaid programs, but action needs to be taken so our society's most vulnerable have access to affordable insurance coverage and are no longer left behind. The AMA was an important early supporter of the Affordable Care Act when it was moving through Congress in 2010. We supported it because we believed then, as we believe now, that the ACA was the best route for increasing health coverage to the millions that could not otherwise obtain it without overturning our entire health system in the process. Momentum is now on the ACA side to use the law as the foundation to cover more of the nation's uninsured. The next 2 years will give us a critical window to see how the law can function with more people eligible for the help they need to afford health insurance coverage. Affordable coverage options under the ACA, the subsidized ACA marketplace coverage, and Medicaid expansion are more critical than ever, providing a much needed safety net for those that have lost their employer-sponsored health insurance coverage because of a job loss during the pandemic. With a new Congress and a new administration in the White House, let's take advantage of this opportunity to make permanent improvements to the ACA to cover more people. Now, beyond making those improvements to the law, we've heard support in many corners for a public option. And it's true that a public option could improve choices for patients by bringing greater competition to the healthcare marketplace, as well as help fill coverage gaps for people in states that haven't expanded Medicaid. But it's crucial that any public option model guarantee that physician payment levels are sufficient to sustain the cost of a medical practice, especially for independent physician practices like mine that have suffered through the economic storm of COVID-19. And physicians need to be able to meaningfully negotiate their payment levels and have the ability to choose whether or not to participate in any public option. So in sum, we find ourselves at a moment when we could truly move forward to cover the remaining uninsured in this country. A sizable majority of the nation's uninsured now are eligible for ACA financial assistance. So let's capitalize on this reality as we move forward. Let's target our efforts on those that remain uninsured and those who remain ineligible for financial help they need to afford health insurance coverage. There can be no greater and more important role for organized medicine whether it's at the state or the national level, than to champion policies that make our health system more affordable, more accessible, and more equitable for everyone. So thank you again for this opportunity to join you for this important discussion. I look forward to the questions after Dr. Cooney's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bailey. Dr. Cooney.
Well, thank you. First of all, congratulations, Dr. Bailey, on your presidency and then the AMA. And sorry, it's been a Zoom presidency, I think, this year, because I think you would have been on the road a lot. And Governor Kitzhaber, thank you so much for moderating this, and to Andrew and the rest of Eugene City Club for having this forum. So the ACP, over the last few years, has worked extensively on addressing the very issues that Dr. Bailey described so nicely, and Dr. Kitzhaber laid out the challenges. And we have sort of labeled this effort what we call Better as Possible, and it's our vision for how we achieve universal access to healthcare in the United States. And just by way of background, the American College of Physicians, many people may not really know who we are. We're the Specialty Society of Internal Medicine Specialists and Subspecialists. And we have 163,000 members across the globe, which makes us the largest medical specialty society in the world. And obviously, the AMA is a larger organization because it represents all the specialties in medicine. So just so people have an understanding of, you know, who we are respectively. So as we addressed our Better as Possible, we wanted to create our vision for a better healthcare system. And it included a lot of the elements. And I think already you're hearing from both the governor and from Dr. Bailey about what those elements might be. One is we feel every American has to have coverage at a cost they, and this is really critical because Governor Kitzhaber brought this up, at a cost the country can afford. There should be essential services, which are in many cases covered at no cost to patients. That really importantly, payment and delivery systems would focus on value to patients for the value of the care provided by them and by their physicians. And this is sort of a nice way of saying, let's stop paying for volume and let's start paying for value. And it would overcome barriers to care, including social determinants of care, of health and discrimination in care. And as boy, if anything, this last year has told us how important investment in public health should be. And that's really part of ours. So as we embarked on this journey for Better as Possible, we asked a series of questions. One, why do so many Americans lack coverage for the care that they need? Why is the U.S. healthcare so expensive and therefore unaffordable for many? How do delivery and payment systems affect costs, access, quality, and equity? What barriers to healthcare, in addition to coverage and cost, do patients face? And what are some of the issues around social determinants? We conducted a very thorough review of the economic, public health, public policy, and social sciences literature in order to answer these questions. And what do we find? We found that American healthcare is, one, too expensive; two, it leaves too many without coverage; it spends too much on administrative costs; it results in inequitable outcomes; it undervalues primary care, it undermines the patient-physician relationship, it enables social and economic circumstances to dictate health and health outcomes, and it grossly underinvests in public health. Just to highlight a few of our findings, and we could go on for the entire time with this, but just as one example, the U.S. spends far more on health than any other industrial country by far. And that's a combination, as the Governor Kitzhaber outlined, not only of public spending, but private spending and out-of-pocket spending. We spend far more than others, and yet we have, for the most part, worse outcomes. Just as one example, we have the highest rate of avoidable deaths among our peer countries. And even despite being insured, many Americans really report increasing difficulty affording their health care. They report that it's becoming increasingly difficult to afford the cost of their health insurance each month. They're increasingly difficult to afford the co-pays for their doctor visits and prescription drugs, and increasingly difficult to just to pay the deductibles that they have to pay before their insurance kicks in. So this led us, therefore, to develop a series of policy recommendations with the supporting evidence that we could call from the economic, social sciences, and related literature. And we published these in January of 2020 in a series of papers that were published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And I'll put a link into the chat here in just a little bit for these articles, which are all open source. And so, but the four principal papers that were in the supplement were, one, our summary paper, which we labeled the call to action by the college. We addressed, as was alluded to here by Governor Kitzhaber and Dr. Bailey, issues around coverage and cost of care. We very importantly spent a great deal of time and text on the healthcare delivery and payment system reforms. And then critically, and I'm glad Governor Kitzhaber brought this issue up, we addressed reducing barriers to care and addressing social determinants of health. And just in the last couple of minutes here, I'll just very high level view of where we landed. First, we really felt that the United States needed to transition to a system that achieves universal coverage with essential benefits and, very importantly, lower administrative costs. We felt the coverage should not be dependent on a person's place of residence, their employment, their health status, or their income. And the coverage, as I think Dr. Bailey was really getting at when she talked about reimbursement, has to be ensure that there's sufficient access to clinicians, hospitals, and other sources of care. We identified really two pathways. One is either through a single payer financing approach, or two, as Dr. Bailey alluded to, a publicly financed coverage option that could be offered along with, and this is very important, a regulated private insurance market. Now, clearly, single payer and public choice models will have advantages and disadvantages. Under a single payer plan, everyone would have the same coverage to the public plan. There would be much lower administrative costs, and it would be more equitable care because of the level playing field. But clearly, it would be more disruptive because there would be limited or no role for private insurance. And I think Dr. Bailey has already alluded to this. Under a public choice option, again, everyone would have coverage, but it would either be under the public plan or through regulated private insurance. It would lower administrative costs, but there would be less savings than with single payer. It would be more equitable than the current system, but less than under a single payer. It would require much more market regulation, but it would be less disruptive because there would be a continued role for private insurance in the kind of independent practices that Dr. Bailey practices in. I just want to mention quickly some of the issues around delivery and payment systems reforms, because we recommend increasing payments for primary and comprehensive care services. The U.S. grossly underinvests in primary care. We would redefine the role of performance measures to focus on value and get away from the issue of volume, as Governor Kitzhaber mentioned. We would eliminate the sort of check-the-box reporting of measures, which bogs physicians down and keeps us away from the bedside and the time with our patients. And we would better align payment incentives with better outcomes and lower costs. And finally, really focus on ending unnecessary, inefficient, and administrative requirements. I look forward to having more time to talking about the social determinants aspects that Governor Kitzhaber so appropriately emphasized. And just to highlight that our earlier 2018 paper goes into even greater detail, and again, would direct people there. So in summary, we do think better is possible and that we can ensure coverage for all. And using either the two approaches we describe, we believe all persons that would be enrolled in a plan that covers essential benefits and that they should, the mandatory enrollment that Dr. Bailey referred to. I think their essential benefits should be established through a process that includes physician and patient and other stakeholder engagement, very much like what Governor Kitzhaber did years ago with the Oregon Health Plan. Eliminate patient cost sharing that creates barriers to evidence-based high value and essential care. And recognizing that these approaches could result in a substantial administrative savings, and that would also reduce burdens on physician and patients. I would also highlight that we did examine market-based approaches and that we felt that none would achieve our vision for universal coverage and access to the care that people need. And this is really the key part, at a cost that we and the country can continue to afford into the future. So I thank you for giving me some time to share those thoughts, and I really look forward to our discussion.
That's great. Thank you very much, Tom. And when I read your paper, I saw the notation of you, we have to have a way to define essential benefits. And I thought of the original Health Services Commission back in the day, which is still operating, by the way.
Yeah.
Let me just start with a pretty broad question. Given the difficulty in moving significant legislation through a deeply divided Congress, how can we get the House of Medicine on the same page? What are the areas of sort of commonality between the ACP approach and the AMA approach that could give us, you know, more political juice on both sides of the aisle, particularly over the next couple of years? Dr. Bailey?
Well, just listening to our two presentations, I think you can see that the general principles are, you know, widely agreed upon. You know, we believe that everybody should have coverage, should have access to high quality care, that administrative burden needs to be reduced, and that we need to invest in the social determinants of health to improve the health of everyone. And I think that, the political calculus in Washington, you know, if that were easy, somebody would have figured it out a long time ago. Shifting back and forth concerns me in that if we invest too much power in Washington in terms of setting, healthcare financing policy for the entire country, we'll continue to see swings in priorities and in reimbursement that I don't think our healthcare system would be able to tolerate. A lot of people don't really understand how the AMA makes policy, and if you'll give me a second, I'll explain that. The American Medical Association, House of Delegates, is the policymaking body for the AMA. The policies that I've discussed have not been based on, discussions around a boardroom table. These are policies that are debated at length by almost 200 state and specialty societies, or every state, every specialty, from medical students to retired physicians, academic physicians, independent physicians, those in integrated practice. So it is a broad microcosm of the practice of medicine in America. And I believe that, our AMA makes good democratic policy. And I would propose looking at that as a way that we can move forward, getting all sides together.
Dr. Cooney?
Dr. Bailey, thank you for that. And actually, what's really fun about this is I'm used to seeing you up on the Jumbotron at the House of Delegates meeting where she has presided previously as speaker. And she's absolutely right. The House of Delegates is this really probably feels a little bit chaotic at times, but wonderfully democratic and spirited development of policy. The American College of Physicians actually is very much literally also has deep involvement. We have what we call our Board of Governors, which is probably much more like the House of Delegates, our Board of Regents. Very much all of our policy goes through a pretty rigorous outreach to our related specialty societies. So we get broad input on our policies just by way of background. But I agree, I think the question you asked, Governor, is that, how can we advance things? And I think what's really important to know is that we actually do agree substantially with the AMA about the issues around improving the ACA. In fact, we published a paper just a little more than a year ago with recommendations that actually would have sounded very much like what Dr. Bailey was, I think, listing, a lot of really wonderful suggestions for expanding and improving and increasing access to the ACA. And I would agree that the challenges we face and what is clearly a razor-thin margin in our federal level legislation makes advancing more comprehensive reform, at least in the near term, much more challenging. And I think where the opportunities will be in the near term are going to be around issues related to ACA and others. And unfortunately, at least the last round, it looks like it will largely be through reconciliation, because at least to date, we haven't figured out how to get support across the aisles on these issues. So You know, I don't know the answer, and I think Dr. Bailey was spot on. If we had figured that out a long time ago, we wouldn't be having this particular conversation. So in the short term, I think it's going to be focusing on expanding opportunities through the ACA and the related things of Medicaid expansions. The good news is we're seeing states that had long resisted expanding Medicaid now moving in that direction. So I think actually much of the work is going to be probably at the state level in many cases, and we'll have to see what we can expand on at the federal level. Would a single payer option pass in this current Congress? I think we know the answer to that. It wouldn't even get a hearing. We do think that there's ways forward, and we look forward to working with groups like the AMA to try to keep us all moving forward towards the goals that we all have.
Let me put something on your radar screen in this vein, and then we can talk about the social determinants. As you pointed out, I think, Dr. Bailey, these increased subsidies and incentives are really for 21 and 22. And to make them permanent will require, as you say, another reconciliation bill. And for those who don't understand that, it's a parliamentary maneuver that it lets you get around the filibuster. So it lets you pass with 51 votes, which the Democrats have in the Senate, if you include the vice presidential vote. The question of whether we can get those through made permanent is, I think, really questionable. And we could theoretically have a situation 2 years from now when we fall off a cliff. If you recall, during the Great Recession, a lot of the money that propped up the Medicaid program, $86 billion in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, sunsetted in 2011. So just as we were coming out of the recession, Oregon lost $625 million in the Medicaid budget. So I'm sure your organizations are really looking at that. But my biggest concern is what we did in the American Rescue Act is excellent, and we needed to do it. My concern is getting the politics together to make that permanent. And I think that's a real question at this point. On the social determinants of health, I think you are all aware that we saw Black Americans and Indigenous Americans and other people of color dying in disproportionate numbers from COVID-19. And many studies indicate that this is clearly due to a set of structural social inequities that make these populations more likely to have hypertension or diabetes, or poor housing, or fewer economic and educational opportunities. So how do we actually move the dollars into addressing those social investments? And that's my biggest concern about the size of the healthcare budget relative to the size of the medical budget versus the social budgets in other OECD nations. So do you have any thoughts on how we can practically actually make those upstream investments, which is really where we have to start, I think? Let's start with you, Tom.
Thanks. So a couple of quick thoughts about that. First is, you're absolutely right. I think you emphasized in your opening remarks the difference between health and healthcare. And the reality is that we'd like to stay healthy and not really need healthcare, right? That would be a wonderful aspirational goal. But the reality is that, that's not where we are. But getting at your point, I think the way we get the money there are two ways. One is that we actually bring down what we're spending on healthcare. And we do that, I think, through a variety of mechanisms. And I think that you both already alluded to some of those. First is, I just can't help commenting on Uwe Reinhardt's famous statement, it's the price is stupid, right? We know that, first of all, what people get charged and what gets charged has almost no rational basis. Just within any given, if you go in the same city, the same service gets billed at markedly different levels and often bears no relationship to the actual cost of producing a service. So we have a huge problem in this country that what is charged for services often bears no relationship to their value or what they actually really should cost. And we've got to address that. The second is that the reality is our fee-for-service system, and it's just human behavior. We're all human, and it drives volume. There's just no getting around that. And as long as we rely on a fee-for-service system, rather than a value-based system, and we can get into that in a moment, I think we won't achieve the savings that we need to do. The other observation I want to make, because it's really relevant to the solution you're talking about, is that the core issues around the social determinants of health are not actually healthcare budget issues. They're issues around poverty. There are issues around food policy. There are issues around access to equitable educational resources. So, you know, as you're saying, we have to have money to spend there. And I will say that the recently passed legislation is actually one of the biggest improvements we have seen that will address social determinants of health, because it's going to lift an enormous number of children out of poverty. We need to make that permanent and keep those kids out of poverty, because that probably will have a bigger impact on their health than many of the other things that we do in healthcare systems. The other observation, and then I'll look forward to Dr. Bailey's comments on this, is that if you look at total sort of spending related to health and healthcare in our sort of comparator countries, they're actually similar. Mm-hmm. So they spend less on healthcare, but they spend a lot more on what I would call sort of social services and social structure. So in the end, we'll ultimately probably, if we were to, you know, in a perfect system and I could just, you know, wave a wand and change it, we would spend a lot more on those elements. We would still have high quality healthcare, but be spending less on that high quality healthcare. And we probably would overall have a healthier population that could contribute more to our economic development and our productivity and everything else. But Dr. Bailey?
Thanks, Tom. The AMA's Council on Medical Service, which is essentially our socioeconomics council, issued a very long and thorough report on the social determinants of health and how to incentivize these efforts. And, you know, the first thing, we believe very strongly in public-private partnerships, and at all levels of government, we think that would be helpful with the private sector, with philanthropic organizations, with faith-based organizations, community-based organizations. The AMA is currently participating in an effort in Chicago on the West Side, investing in the businesses in this part of Chicago, and then measuring health outcomes by investing in non-health related issues. And so we're very anxious to see how that will proceed. But, you know, we also need to look at the gathering of data to find out, well, what works. You know, we in our hearts know that people need and deserve good housing and food and nutrition and education, but what efforts really make the most difference? And I think that we need to study that very, very carefully, encouraging, you know, pilot programs addressing non-medical issues that impact medical outcomes. And I think Tom's comment about how other nations, you know, spend less money on healthcare but more money on some of the social issues is fascinating. And I, I would love to see some of that data. But when I referring back to the slide that you showed, Tom, in your talk about what is spent in, you know, various countries for health, I have, as an AMA leader, had the privilege, not as much as I would have liked this past year because of the pandemic, but to visit other countries and visit their health systems. And it was fascinating to participate in discussions at the British Medical Association's House of Delegates. And over, you know, I heard the refrain, we don't spend enough on healthcare. We need to spend more on healthcare. We need to increase the amount of our GDP that is spent on healthcare. So, you know, yes, I think we can all agree that ours is too much. UK's may or may not be too low, but, you know, where's the Goldilocks that's just right?
So, Andrew, do you have a question from your audience there that you'd like to get in?
Yes, we have a couple of folks who have submitted questions. Michael Huntington, feel free to turn on your video and ask one of your questions, at least to start, of our panelists. And you can choose which one you'd like to ask.
Okay, the first one is this question. Value-based payment, shifting insurance risks on to providers of care, introduces unwanted incentives to skimp on care and avoid care of sicker, more complex, and socially disadvantaged patients and populations. In other words, cherry picking. The value-based solutions involve pay for quality outcomes and risk adjustment. Still, both are far too complex to do accurately, and they are failing to deter skimping on care and cherry-picking by healthcare systems, hospitals, and doctors. Can we shift from this well-intentioned alternative to standard fee-for-service to a better fee-for-service based on time spent with the patient and documentation and the provider's level of training? Much simpler, fairer, and resulting in decreased burnout for providers. Better yet, salary all providers under a publicly governed global budget for the state.
Whoa, that's quite a question. Tom?
Wow. Michael, thanks for that. there's a lot to unpack there, I would say. So I guess a couple of things. One is, I think you actually finished in a really fascinating place, which was global budgeting, which is a little bit different approach than is the value-based approach, and does, I think, offer an example of a way to, avoid some of the kind of risk of, as you say, cherry-picking. And I would just highlight our current system. I mean, you know, we know that insurance companies love nothing better than to insure healthy people and to avoid insuring not healthy people. So there's always, you know, I think incentives for there to be cherry picking. One of the attractiveness of a global budgeting system, particularly if you just have a population of patients for whom you're responsible and you don't get to sort of, you know, call out the less attractive ones, is that then you can then organize the system of healthcare in which you're working to really meet the needs of that population and move the resources around and right size everything. So, you know, for example, that you don't have an excess of technology, that you don't have an excess of very high cost, you know, of expensive subspecialists beyond what you need that drive volume. You can hold yourself accountable. I think we've seen that actually with, for example, the pandemic and the ability recently of whether systems were able to respond because they were globally budgeted or not. You know, it was, I think as Dr. Bailey alluded to, this pandemic has been devastating to both hospitals and to independent practices because particularly, you know, I'll speak surgical practices. I mean, my goodness, they were really slammed because they couldn't operate. Their volumes were down. Where paradoxically, you know, other types of practices. Whereas in a globally budgeted system, people were continuing to get their revenues. They could reorganize themselves. They could start doing telemedicine, outreach, do those kinds of resources. So there's a lot of, I think, value in the global budgeted approach. The value-based gets around some of the issues of, paying for volume rather than value, but there's disagreements about which value, how do you measure the value, et cetera. So it's not at all perfect. And I just want to return, I think, Dr. Bailey, you were spot on when you said, you know, you go to the UK and they want to spend more. I think we would all agree that there is no perfect system. And wherever we get, I think we're always going to be looking to make better, whatever, wherever we get to, we should always be looking to make it better.
Oh, good. Dr. Huntington, I'll try to take a stab at the many issues that you brought up. First of all, my personal concern with value-based care is, like Dr. Cooney said, the difficulty in defining value. Value means one thing, and it means, you know, to a surgeon, it means another thing to an allergist, it means another thing to a pathologist. And who defines the value often decides, you know, where the money goes. And but the enhanced fee for service, as may not be exactly the way you said it, but I'm sure that you're aware that we have had the first major revision in E&M coding that took effect at the beginning of 2021. It's the biggest change that we've had in 25 years to make sure that physicians don't have to spend so much time checking boxes, writing, notes that go on forever just so that they can get paid, but they can use time-based payments in the way that they see fit to best take care of their patients. And then I'm just going to just throw one other, thought out there and we can move on to the next question. Several years ago, the state of Hawaii, whose major carrier covers, almost 3/4 of the island's, private insurance population, went to a strictly capitated system for all of their physicians. And the well-established physicians that had a lot of patients were doing very well. And the younger physicians in less established practices were having an incredibly difficult time making it work. And I think that just shows the one of the pitfalls of sudden major shifts in payment policy, how that can affect a physician population and structure that's not really ready for it.
Michael, really quickly, we have an example here in Oregon. I mean, the coordinated care organizations operate on a global budget, which is, and the real cost savings there, and the global budget is based on some assumptions about the capitation rate. The real cost savings weren't from the rate, it was from the trend. We limited that to a 3.4% per member per year growth rate. And that's where the real cost savings are. So if you were to negotiate physician fees, if you're going to go to a capitated system, you have to make some assumptions on utilization benefit as well as the fee schedule. You can have a very generous, 200%, 250% of Medicare, you get front and load primary care. But the real cost savings is going to be then operating within that growth trend. And they're trying to do that in Massachusetts. We've passed one of those here in Oregon for the commercial market with a 4-year rollout. So I do think there's a way to if you decide that that's the rate you want to grow and create a glide path, as Dr. Bailey says, I'm very confident the system can get there.
Thank you.
We have a few minutes left. So maybe one more question from our live virtual audience. Sam Metz, if you want to ask, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Andrew. This is quite an impressive panel. A hypothetical, if all of the options were to preserve the average provider payment levels, should professional physician organizations favor a single payer option, a public option, or protecting the Affordable Care Act?
Got to go to one of the doctors from the professional organizations. I have no portfolio.
That's quite a hypothetical. I think one concern that I have is that we all know that there's much more to making our practices run smoothly and taking good care of our patients than the fee schedule. What is the liability climate? What are the administrative burdens that I have to put up with? Prior authorization is just an incredibly destructive element in a physician practice in terms of taking time and depriving care of patients. A significant number of physician practices will tell you that they have had patients that have had dramatic adverse outcomes because of step therapy and prior authorization policies. And so I think that, for me, I would want to pick the system that, as an independent physician, gives me the most freedom to take care of the patients in the way that I choose and minimizes my administrative burden so that I can spend more time at the bedside. AMA data showed that for every hour a physician spends at the bedtime, they spend 2 hours in administrative tasks. And to me right now, that looks like an improved Affordable Care Act.
Tom, you have anything to add there before we wrap up?
No, I think Dr. Bailey has said it well. And, you know, I think we have to be pragmatic. I think we have to just keep moving forward, always trying to get to the best possible place that we can, recognizing the very real realities of the political environment in which we operate and the changes we're trying to make. So the ACP's positions are aspirational. That's where we would like to get there, but we're going to continue to work on the same kind of issues that Dr. Bailey so nicely highlighted.
Well, thank both of you for participating today, and I'll just kick it back to Andrew to close us out.
Thank you very much, Governor, and thank you, Drs. Bailey and Cooney. Fantastic conversation, and right on schedule as always. Thank you, our listening audience and our viewing audience, for tuning in, and we will see you next time at the City Club of Eugene. Have a nice day.
This has been our March 26th, 2021 program, How Can We Achieve Universal Access to Healthcare? Sponsored by the Oregon Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, advocating better care to more people for less money in Oregon and nationally. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our Diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. LCC provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to acknowledge our gold sponsors, Jerry Detelm, architect and landscape architect, Luvash Cobb, attorneys at law, and AARP of Oregon, and our sapphire sponsor, Summit Bank. Summit Bank is an independent community bank headquartered in Eugene, serving businesses and professionals in Eugene, Springfield, and Central Oregon communities. For more information, visit sbko.bank. Before we thank our speakers today, I have a few more quick announcements. Thank you to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography, and a special thank you to public radio station KLCC FM 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page. If you are a City Club of Eugene member, you can ask a question at a future taping of our programs. If you are not yet a member, you can join and then participate. More information is on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Next week, our program focuses on Eugene Downtown Riverfront Redevelopment Project, A River Flows Through It. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, I would like to thank today's speakers for a great program. John Kitzhaber, Susan Bailey, and Tom Cooney, thank you very much for sharing your insights and expertise on this important issue. This concludes today's program. Be well and stay safe.